This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 1960s, a time of sweeping change in politics and culture, and it came with a heck of a soundtrack. Journalist and writer Fry Gilyard tries to recapture the zeitgeist of the 60s in his latest book. It's called A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. Fry Gilyard is a writer in residence at the University of South Alabama and a former Southern editor at the Charlotte Observer. Fry, welcome, and welcome back to North Carolina.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be back.
So you do remember the 1960s?
You know, it's funny, but I do. Yeah, when the decade started, I was in junior high school. Mm-hmm. And when it ended, I had just graduated from college and was just starting out as a reporter interested in covering the kind of things that had been going on during the 60s, civil rights and racial issues and war and peace and all of those kind of things.
Your book is a fascinating reflection of those periods because it includes your personal story. It's part memoir and, of course, part memoir of the decade. So talk about how the 60s sort of came to you in middle school.
Well, you know, one of the earliest memories that has any kind of political or social content was the inauguration of President Kennedy in 1963. And I remember my eighth grade teacher turning on the television so we could watch. And she said, when she turned it on, she said, "I just love things like this." And I didn't really know what she meant, but somehow it seemed such a personal thing that she said. And so I paid careful attention to the inaugural address, and I saw this handsome young president saying these incredibly idealistic things, and even at that sort of politically unaware age, I was kind of inspired. And then a couple of years later, when I was in high school, I was on a high school field trip. I lived in Mobile, Alabama, but I was on a high school field trip to Birmingham. And I happened to get there the weekend that Martin Luther King was leading civil rights demonstrations. And I came out of my hotel and walked right onto the arrest of Dr. King by these two Birmingham policemen. And they were pushing him roughly up the sidewalk, only a couple of feet from where I was standing. And I saw Dr. King's face, and there was this look of deep sadness in his eyes, I thought. And I was not very tuned in to any of this. But suddenly that history that was taking shape had a face for me, and it was the face of Martin Luther King. And it was just disturbing because he seemed so gentle and serene, and the two policemen who were handling him so roughly seemed to be so mean and thuggish. And that was just unsettling to me as a kid. And I think just in a visceral kind of way, it sort of opened me up to what was going on. I didn't know what to think about it yet, but I wanted to figure it out.
Did you have any sense? You talked about saying, you know, the fact that you hadn't done too much thinking about it, but you're a white man in Mobile, Alabama in 1963. So I'm wondering if your empathy for Dr. King at that moment presented any kind of a challenge for you. What do I do with this feeling?
Yeah, it did. Because I had been raised in a not mean-spirited, but very conservative white family that was very much a part of the status quo. And so I did not expect to feel this sudden surge of sympathy that I did feel for Dr. King. And so that was internally something that I had to wrestle with. And more as the decade went by, and I realized that that really was how I felt, that racial injustice became a great preoccupation for me, as it did for some others raised in the South. You know, that was something, you know, we knew we were swimming upstream in our particular area. So, you know, it made you think.
It made you think. War and peace, of course, other environmental issues, all of them that you take on in your book. By the end of that decade, now you're working as a journalist. Talk about that decision.
Well, there was so much that was unfolding. I was a history major at Vanderbilt. I wasn't a journalism major. They didn't have journalism as a major there. But I was thinking about current events from the through the lens of being a history major. And you could see that history was unfolding. I mean, there was the war in Vietnam. There was the civil rights movement. After a while, there were the urban riots. There was the women's movement and the growing consciousness among female students at Vanderbilt that they had issues that confronted women. Later in the decade, the environmental movement took shape, as you said. And so I just knew that I wanted to connect with all of this stuff. And writing about it seemed to be one way to do it. And so I just went into journalism.
Now, talk about the book itself these many decades later. I mean, it's difficult to take on any 10-year period, but that one, in many ways, that one in particular, because the amount of change, turbulence, and the cross currents that we're running through. Why did you decide to take this on?
Part of it was looking around at the situation today that was emerging when I began to think about this 5 years ago, and that's when I started writing the book. I had been kind of discouraged and dismayed by what seemed to me to be a racial backlash against President Obama. I mean, it's fine to disagree with some of his policies. I disagreed with some myself, although I mostly liked him. But I thought the demonization of President Obama by a lot of people in the country had to have racial roots. That's what it seemed to me. And so I was thinking about how things that I hoped had changed maybe had not changed as much. And that kind of took me back to the 60s and to the way I saw them unfold and the way I experienced them. And I also happened to be rereading at that point David Halberstam's great book, The 50s. And while I only compare myself in a limited way to David Halberstam, still I thought maybe a similar book on the 60s would work. It took me a while to figure out how to do it. And there were two major kind of breakthroughs in terms of figuring out the organization. One of them was the decision to blend history with a little bit of memoir. It's mostly history, but where my own experiences add to an understanding, then I tried to put them in. I decided to do that. And then later, after working on it, reading up on it for a couple of years, I was trying to figure out how to organize it. And it hit me to do it in the most obvious way, which is chronologically, year by year, 1960, 61, 62. And if you do that, then you can weave all sorts of strands through that. So you can talk about race relations and civil rights and black power and those kind of things. You can also talk about the women's movement. You can talk about music. You can talk about the space race. You can talk about other cultural things like sports when they were relevant. And so once I had the structure and the decision to blend history and memoir, then it was just plunging in and trying to do it.
Well, let us plunge in right now and do it chronologically. 1960, a history that can start right here in North Carolina.
Absolutely. Down in Greensboro on January 31st, 1960, you have four college freshmen in a dormitory bull session, young African-American men who find themselves talking about the crippling insult of segregation that they face every day of their lives. The segregated lunch counters, the white-only restrooms, all of those kind of things, sitting in the back of the bus. And they're talking about their parents' generation and how that generation didn't do enough to fight back. And then they said to each other, but what have we done? And their answer was nothing. And so the next day, without any kind of planning or preparation, they go down to the Woolworth store downtown and sit in at the lunch counter. Just an amazing act of spontaneous courage by four very bright and idealistic young men. And their example just triggered a whole movement, and within 2 weeks, there were more than 50 cities and towns in the South that had those kind of demonstrations. And there was such idealism in its purest form. You know, young African-American kids, sometimes with white supporters, dressed in their Sunday finest, going to sit in to buy a hot dog or a hamburger or a tuna fish sandwich, and their dignity such a contrast to the hecklers who turned out to greet them. And all of this continued, you know, through the early 60s, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, all of that idealism, all of that hope, all of that sense of possibility. So that's the way I think it started out, and the decade began to gain momentum from that.
And all of that was aimed at raising the consciousness, not only raising the consciousness of African-Americans and the hope that, through some kind of civil organization and direct action, change could happen,
right,
but also the consciousness of white America that
Absolutely.
May have thought there wasn't a problem here. And
right.
this kind of thing did it, but it probably was 1963 when white America really sat up and took notice at what was going on nationally, but certainly in a fine point in the South, the Birmingham bombing.
Right, right. September 15th, 1963, the bomb goes off. Four young girls are killed. Another is blinded. Later, two more black children are killed in the aftermath. You know, it was a horrifying thing. And so this kind of cloud began to appear on the horizon of the 60s, too, as we realized that the other great storyline besides hope was going to be the storyline of tragedy and violence and division. 2 months later, after Dr. King has given his I Have a Dream speech, the bombing and then the assassination of President Kennedy. And so we realized it was going to be a decade that would have, you know, difficulty as well as hope. And then the Vietnam War followed that.
What is it like for you now? I'm wondering, I'm always curious about this when historians and writers go back, particularly if they were paying attention at the time.
Right.
The difference between your sense of what all of that meant while it was happening, as you look back as a historian and a researcher, and what you were feeling at the time.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was convey how it felt at the time. And so, in a way, even the historical parts of the book have a kind of personal edge to them. Because there was such a powerful reaction that many of us had to these events as they took place. You know, the kids who were killed in Birmingham were, you know, not very different in age from some of the rest of us. And so those kind of things, you feel them in a more personal way. You look back on it, and there is, I suppose, more of a sense of detachment, more a sense of an overview. And yet, for somebody like me who lived through it, it's easy to summon the feelings that I had at the time. And I think as you read the book, they're probably there in the writing.
And you interviewed the father of one of the victims of the Birmingham bombing.
I did. His name was Claude Wesley, and his daughter Cynthia was killed in the bombing. And it was maybe, if I had to pick in over what's now a pretty long career as a journalist, if I had to pick the one interview that moved me the most, it might be Claude Wesley, because I asked him about how it felt to listen to Martin Luther King in the eulogy for his daughter call for forgiveness. And I wondered, wouldn't bitterness be a more natural response? And he said, oh, no. He said, we were never bitter. He said, that wouldn't have been fair to Cynthia, because we tried to deal with her death the same way we dealt with her life, and bitterness had no place in that. And he said, there was one more thing. We never asked why us, because that would be the same thing as asking why not somebody else. And he said, a Christian can't ask that question. It was an amazing statement by this man of great compassion and dignity and decency, and I never forgot it.
More traumatic moments in the 1960s, 1968, two assassinations, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy.
Right. Martin Luther King was, we couldn't believe that had happened. One of the powerful moments that followed it was Bobby Kennedy going to Indianapolis and talking about it in the black area of town, the inner city of Indianapolis, quoting the Greek philosopher Aeschylus, saying, in our hearts, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop until against our will comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. I'm not getting the quote exact, but it was an amazing philosophical, compassionate reaching out to this crowd. And Indianapolis was the only major city in America where there was no riot that night. Who knows if that's coincidence or not. And then 2 months later, Kennedy himself is killed. And I had met him briefly. He came to Vanderbilt where I was a student. and I talked to him a little bit, and so it felt very personal to me when he was killed. And he and Dr. King, for me and for some others, were kind of the last hope of idealism as the decade was growing more and more dark.
Talk more about that and the way the decade ends, this, because the cultural changes, obviously, enormous changes in music, clothing styles, all of those things. Feminist movement is beginning to rise. Women are now asserting their rights. All of this is happening in this moment. And as you said, now we look back and think, was there any progress at all if we look at what's going on? And of course there was in some ways. But how do you see where we are now with respect to the 60s? What was that moment for you as you look back now?
I think that we certainly made some progress in some areas. Progress is fragile. It's not inherently permanent, as we're learning with the issues of race and other things. You know, legal segregation ended during that period of time. We did attempt to come to terms with the issue of poverty in America, with programs by President Johnson and others that were controversial, did actually do some good, but also had some problems with them. But it just was a reminder to me that, you know, you can get through difficult times, things can get better, but the story doesn't end at any particular time. And so you have to keep working at it.
One of the things you talked about, the programs that did have a great deal of success, they certainly needed some fine-tuning, but they had enormous success in alleviating poverty and the gap between the wealth gap, which was much smaller. And in many, many ways, people were better cared for than they are today. It was an opening into social democracy, the idea that people were participating, that government could provide with the assent and certainly the oversight of the people for a great many of the needs. Has that window closed?
I think it certainly has closed more than we saw in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And whether it'll close altogether remains to be seen. I mean, we have the kind of budget deficits now that make it harder to fund those programs, and yet the income gap in America is getting wider.
Well, the budget deficits are the result of tax cuts.
And that's exactly
right. Differential. I mean, there was certainly 70% tax, and business was booming in the 50s and 60s. So that wasn't the problem. The problem was the change in international trade and all kinds of other complex things that people don't want to look at that were happening in the 70s.
Right.
So yeah, if you'd get back to some of those tax rates, you'd have plenty of money to provide.
I think that's right. And I think one of the things that's happened is it's become kind of an article of faith in our politics that the more you cut taxes, the better. That wasn't true back then, although Johnson and Kennedy did try to cut taxes. But they wanted to have enough money in the government to do some of the other things. And, you know, we need to talk about that.
Fry Gilyard is the author of A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. Writer in residence at the University of South Alabama, former Southern editor of the Charlotte Observer. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Appreciate it. Good to be here.
Fry is going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tonight, 7 o'clock. Teaches a day-long course at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Duke University tomorrow. And is going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh Saturday, January 19th. We've got all that at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we want to bring some music to you and bring you a pianist who wants to do that and bring music to people all around the world. Panos Karin is next on The State of Things. Stay tuned.